Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we find non-market solutions to the housing crisis on Housing Party and unpack how housing access affects reproductive rights on abortion. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, the MB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 23 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a new episode, the team trace a brief history of Canadian nationalisms, including earlier attempts at imagining a socialist national project in order to better understand the current moment of rising nationalist sentiment. Now, here's the show.
We are, either we like it or not, part of an artificial country with very little meaning called Canada.
Makes no difference where I go.
The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/AlbertaAdvantage.
The best hometown I know.
Hello, and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, William, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Dave.
Greetings.
And our Lower Canada correspondent, Liam.
Bonjour.
For the past 6 months, you've probably heard a lot of people talking about elbows up in Canada. This is a hockey term about playing defensively, but the phrase has recently worked its way into public discourse much more widely than merely among sports fans, and it's become a sort of political statement. Trump's repeated references to Canada as the 51st state of the United States has reportedly produced a surge of patriotic elbows-up sentiment among Canadians. This, I think, can partly be seen in the miraculous recovery of the Liberal Party, which in January was polling towards a historic electoral wipeout. But since dumping Justin Trudeau as leader and replacing him with former central banker Mark Carney, and then calling a snap election on the question of Canada's relationship with the United States, has produced a rare fourth Liberal term and just a hair short of a majority government. Given the current successes of right-wing populist nationalisms around the world in propelling figures like Trump into power, it's surprising that an unpopular centrist government like the Liberals managed to ride a patriotic wave to re-election. And the Liberals campaign on elbows up while Pierre Poilievre's Conservatives belatedly adopted a Canada First slogan with less success. So why does Canada seemingly buck the trend? And is there such a thing as a progressive nationalism that the Liberals tried to sell us during this election? So in today's episode, we're going to examine Canadian nationalism to provide some answers to these questions. First off, we argue that there are competing Canadian nationalisms, which not only offer contested visions of the country, but might even seek to break away from it, or even question whether Canada should be a sovereign nation at all. We are, in fact, a land of contrasts. So we'll survey some of the history of these with some emphasis on the period since 1945, when we get more intentional nation-building projects to define Canada, such as the adoption of our current red-white maple leaf flag in 1965. Secondly, we want to explore working-class politics in the context of Canadian nationalism, because we think the particular histories of these both here don't lend themselves to a simple dichotomy of class versus nation, which you might find elsewhere. In other words, Canadian nationalism has not always functioned as a rhetorical trick to distract workers from the socialist movement, but is sometimes interconnected with anti-imperialist sentiments. However, settler colonialism deeply structures class and nation in ways that contain these radical possibilities. And finally, we are not arguing in favor of another Canadian left nationalist synthesis. We remain deeply skeptical of this being anything other than a political dead end. That said, confidently telling your friends, family, and coworker that Canada is fake is not a very persuasive argument. Yet this elbows-up feeling is grounded in a repulsion from Trump and his right-wing populism, as well as anxieties over Canada's relationship to a rotting U.S. empire. There are progressive political opportunities here that the left needs to engage with. So let's run through all of this, and at the end of the episode, try to perhaps imagine, if you will, a socialist, quote-unquote, nation-building project founded on other sorts of collective solidarities, perhaps somewhere better to connect our subjectivities about belonging to something larger than ourselves.
So a classic conception of Canada is as a nation of two solitudes, so much to the point that it's kind of a hackneyed thing to say. And these two solitudes are, of course, the gulf between English and French societies, Anglophone and Francophone societies. And our historical trajectory is one of overcoming this division and, you know, perhaps living in a bilingual paradise or something like that. The most obvious counterpoint to that is that Quebec sovereignty exists. And this has been a very, very strong current in 20th century and 21st century Canadian and Quebec politics, and they want out. But there is a more fundamental tension here, and that's the dispossession of Indigenous people and their land by Anglophone and indeed Francophone settlers. In Mohawk Interruptus, which is this really wonderful book that I highly recommend, Ginyengahaga, or Mohawk, scholar Audra Simpson, examines the politics of sovereignty in her own community of Ganawage, which is on the south shore of Montreal. She introduces this notion of nested sovereignty that we think is really, really useful when thinking through settler colonialism in Canada and Canadian nationalisms. In short, what Simpson means by this is that the potential for Indigenous sovereignty is held within the constraints of the national container. That is Canada or Quebec or Alberta or the USA or perhaps even other settler states, if we can bring it there. For Indigenous sovereignty to actually be actualized, it has to come at the expense of settler sovereignty and vice versa. For settler societies to exist, to make policy as nation state, all of that kind of stuff, it comes at the expense of Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous land. And so when we're talking about these like big nation building projects, you know, perhaps it is most obvious thinking about the transcontinental railway, Indigenous sovereignty is impinged upon. Another thing to think about here is that the Canadian nation building project not only takes the land and that very sort of physical idea of, you know, sovereignty, but also absorbs elements of Indigenous culture to construct itself. Art historian Gillian Poulter, in her book Becoming Native in a Foreign Land, examines the birth of various bourgeois Canadian nationalisms in the late 19th century. We're talking mostly about the kind of hoity-toity, Laurentian elite, Montreal Anglo type, and their appropriation of Indigenous activities, artistic motifs, and performances to create a distinctly Canadian nationalism. And to do this, she draws upon the often incomprehensible post-colonial theorist Homi Bhabha to show how this appropriation worked. A really big example is lacrosse, which is originally a Haudenosaunee game called Bagadaway. It was reframed and regulated into Victorian ideals of sport, making it acceptable for bourgeois settlers to partake, giving it rules, putting on these like very strict ideas of fair play that very much originated in bourgeois English society. With this, you know, these new Canadian bourgeois, they were able to participate in not just a game, but a sport that was distinctly of this land, but also fundamentally imperial, taking indigenous culture in for settler colonial means. She also mentions snowshoeing on Mount Royal, the photography of William Notman, who's this very noted portrait photographer in Montreal at the time, and even depictions of stuff like snowball fights or tobogganing as part of this building of a Canadian national cultural identity. We've also discussed similar processes of indigenizing settler culture on our recent episode about Alberta nationalist imaginaries. But perhaps most important for our discussion today is Poulter's analysis of the 1885 Northwest Resistance. Now, you could, and you probably should, do a whole podcast just about Métis resistance to colonialism in the 19th century, but here's the short version. After the 1869 to 1870 Red River Resistance, where Louis Riel fought and won the entrance of Manitoba into Confederation and for increased rights for Métis people, more and more Métis people moved west into what is now Saskatchewan, what was then the Northwest Territory. They clashed with white settlers over land, and there were only more and more white settlers coming. Louis Riel, who had been in exile in the U.S. at the time, at the request of Métis leaders, returned to lead another rebellion, another resistance, to secure Métis rights in the Northwest Territories. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, had learned his lesson from the last tussle with Riel, where the Canadians struggled to get troops out to Manitoba. And he'd formed a little organization you might know of called the Northwest Mounted Police, with the express purpose of safeguarding the prairies from Indigenous insurrection and securing settlement. And then, to quote the Headcoats 1992 smash hit on Nardwuar Records, to the tune of Louie Louie, the Métis and the Cree did agree to live on the plains peacefully. But at the Battle of Batoche, their dream was lost. And with their lives, they paid the cost. Poulter goes on to examine the very lavish oil paintings. Like, when you think about like a 19th century painting of like a colonial battle, like you're thinking the right thing, that depicted the battles of this conflict, in which the creation of a distinct Canadian nationalism really crystallized with the vanquishing of Indigenous resistance, fixed perfectly in time in oil on canvas. Our point here is that the 19th century Canadian nationalism that we might consider perhaps the base layer of the Canadian nationals we might see expressed today was fundamentally created and crystallized and reinforced through the process of settler colonialism. Settler colonialism and its associated myriad violences are integral to any sort of Canadian nationalism. It's the bedrock that Canada is really built upon. A Canadian nation cannot exist without having first stolen the land. And this goes for Quebec as well.
Does the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Housing Party with Montreal housing advocate and academic Dr. David Desbailliers has been tackling the country's housing emergency since 2019. On this episode, Dr. Desbailliers sits down with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives' Ricardo Tranjan and Le Front d'Action Populaire en Réaménagement Urbain's François Sayat to explain why non-market solutions are the only way out of the crisis. Now, here's David.
Bonjour, hi, and welcome to Housing Party, the first podcast in Canada to tackle the Canadian housing emergency. We started doing these in 2019, and it feels awesome to be back after a long hiatus in which I worked for the Federal Housing Advocate. Shout out to Marie-Josée Houle. My last podcast was back in October 2022, so please forgive my rustiness. I'm still housing rights advocate, activist, and researcher Dr. David Fried Desbailliers, broadcasting from Montreal, the unceded territory known in Ganyangaiga as Jojage, place where the river breaks. In this show, we explore how housing issues intersect with human rights, and we try to find a way forward through the massive social and economic chaos created by housing markets in Canada. I want to salute Harbinger and my friend, producer Andre Goulet, for supporting my efforts to promote the right to housing and my attempts to raise awareness about housing as a leading determinant of health and a barrier to justice in Canada. The Housing Party still represents the tenant class, la classe locataire out there. These are folks who don't own a home, can't own a home, and in many cases don't want to own a home. At the Housing Party, we take as a given that housing is a basic human right routinely violated by the private housing markets in Canada. Housing policy is pursued by governments of all stripes. And yes, I'm including the NDP in this group. We need federal, provincial, and municipal governments to invest majorly in non-market housing, whether governments build social housing, invest in co-ops, private nonprofits, whatever, all of which needs to end the systemic abuses of tenants, rampant no-fault evictions, growing illegal rent evictions and dem evictions that are destabilizing our communities and uprooting our neighborhoods. So today we're asking the big question: if so many of us are finding ourselves and our basic human rights jeopardized, why aren't elected representatives and media doing more to fix this problem? Or maybe a better question: can we reform the actual housing system to meet the needs of a majority of Canadians, or do we need to replace it with something else entirely? I'm a housing rights advocate, activist, and researcher, Dr. David Fried-Debaillé. I'm broadcasting from Montreal, the unceded territory known in Ganyegahega as Jojage, the place where the river breaks. We are exploring housing issues that intersect with human rights and trying to find a way forward through a massive social and economic chaos created by housing markets in and across Canada. At the Housing Party, we take as a given that housing is a basic human right. It's routinely violated by private housing markets in this country. Housing policy is pursued by governments of all stripes. And yes, I'm including the NDP in this group. Federal, provincial, municipal, political parties need to invest majorly in non-market housing, community, social housing, whatever you want to call it. Whether government-built, social housing co-ops, private nonprofit housing providers, all of which is done with the goal of ending the systemic abuses of tenants, rampant no-fault evictions, growing illegal rent evictions, demo evictions that destabilize people's housing in our communities and uproot our neighborhoods. So today we're asking, as we always do, the million-dollar question: if so many of us are finding ourselves and basic human rights jeopardized, why aren't elected representatives and media doing more to fix this problem? Or maybe a better question would be: can we reform the actual housing system to meet the needs of a majority of Canadians, or do we need to replace it with something else entirely? My guests today are two professional housers, economist and author Ricardo Tranjan, and Catherine Lucier, a leading housing activist, community organizer, spokesperson for Quebec's Tenant Rights and Anti-Poverty Advocacy Coalition, Le Front d'Action Populaire en Réaménagement Urbain, known by its acronym as FRAPRU. Tranjan is a senior researcher at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, where he focuses on Ontario's public finances, the economics of social policy, and especially income support, education, rental housing. His latest book, The Tenant Class, La Classe Locataire, was published in 2023, that is the English version, by Between the Lines, and recently republished in French with a foreword by the legendary Quebec housing rights champion François Saillant, and we'll be talking about that a little later. We will also be discussing elections. We're still in the post-election period in this country. And the new government's housing policies are up in the air. How do we shift the narrative in Canadian policy circles away from simplistic supply-side solutions? This will be one of our big topics today. This is the topic that is favored by both liberals and conservatives. And what we need to talk about in this country is moving away from this obsession with supply and towards protection of tenants' rights, the right to housing in general, addressing the disappearing affordable rental stock across Canada. Also, what is the political class in Canada offering Canadians in terms of the growing crisis in homelessness, the national encampments emergency, the growing unhoused population? So, Ricardo, Catherine, welcome to Housing Party. Really happy you could join us today. I want to start with Ricardo. We're going to talk about your French translation of The Tenant Class, the book that I'm holding here. You won't be able to see this if you're listening, but I guess right off the bat, how is this different from the original, Ricardo?
Hello, David, and thanks for having me. Really happy to be here. Hello, Catherine. Nice to see you again, and hello, everybody else. The French version of The Tenant Class, La Classe Locataire, is a slight adaptation of the English version. It has some new data just to keep us current. It draws more on examples from Quebec and provides more data on Quebec cities. So it kind of hits close to home a little bit. And there's one chapter where I talk a lot about the current movements and what they're doing. That chapter in the French version is a little bit more focused on Quebec, on La Frappeuse, La Haclac, mm-hmm. Matute. But it also has an interesting update of what's happening in Toronto, because when I was writing the book, there's a lot of stuff happening in Toronto, and strikes and rent strikes and other forms of activism were starting to gain a little bit of momentum. So the French version, I could capture that in the French version, whereas it was a little bit too early to talk about that in the English version. So you get a little bit more about Quebec, you get some new data, but also you get to hear about the exciting rent strikes in Toronto.
Yeah, very exciting. And yes, I noted, I think I might be the only person who's read both French and English at this point. No, I'm kidding. But I did note that there's some content in there about Catherine's organization, Frappeuse, and like around the debate on affordable housing, the terminology about affordable housing, and a few other issues as well in housing that are specific to the Quebec context. So, yeah, that's awesome. And tell me a little bit about your relationship with François Saillon. Catherine, I know you're very close to François, but Ricardo, how did you meet François?
I'm just a fan.
Just a fan?
I had met him a couple of times, okay. And he very kindly agreed to write a preface for the French version. And it was great because based on all his knowledge and experience, he managed to situate my analysis in the Quebec context. And essentially, the preface tells Quebecers and Quebec activists why you should read this book, why it is relevant for Quebec too, and not only for other provinces, other parts of Canada.
Yeah.
So it was really great that he did that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's awesome. So since we're talking about Quebec and the sort of differences between Quebec and the ROC, the rest of Canada, a question for both of you. And I know that, you know, the way you frame the housing situation is really key. And I think that's something that you do really well in your book, Ricardo. Trying to move away from the technocratic language around housing. But I do want to ask you, in terms of like socioeconomic housing policies and infrastructure, what do you think Quebec does well and needs to be studied in the rest of Canada?
And what do you think, also in terms of culture, housing culture, what do you think needs to be better understood in the rest of Canada vis-a-vis what's happening in Quebec? And we'll start with Catherine, would you mind?
It's a difficult question at the same time, because we have put Quebec as an example for different things, included, you know, or indirectly rent control, what we don't have in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And that some other provinces with time have acquired some others kind of reglementation and laws that are going towards rent control, even if they're not properly 100% rent control either. Mm-hmm. But we're considering not Quebec as being 100% the model to follow, because we're seeing really a deep transition right now in terms of, if you mentioned vocabulary, that is everything right now, mm-hmm. because it's transitioning towards other things than social housing itself. Yeah. We are also, you know, in the context of financialization, we have a government that's refusing to really go to forward the rent control and protecting more tenants against those abusive rent increase. That we, even though we still have affordable rent, when you look at the rest of Canada, we are losing it, mm-hmm. you know, more and more, because there is not enough protection for tenants. Again, eviction, again, you know, repossessing of dwelling, against all these phenomena that, you know, you see growing for landlord to acquire more profit. So by increasing the rent. So we're actually right now more and more losing in many regions where it was still affordable to live. Mm-hmm. Really high rent increase, really fast one. With the crisis, actual crisis. So we don't think that Quebec right now is the model to follow, because of the direction that is taking right now, and that because there is still lack of protection, and because there is still lack of investment in social housing. Like, for many years, we were happy to say that, like, we have like one dedicated program for developing social housing that have like helped a lot after the retreat of the federal government from it.
Right.
That have built a lot of like social housing over the years, but we don't have it anymore. So we actually have lost a lot of like the advantages that we could had, and we haven't reinforced the protection that could have led to more affordable housing and to protect more the housing stock that was still affordable that we're losing right now.
Yeah, excellent point. Quebec, maybe not the role model, not the greatest example that we have right now of progressive housing policy, and perhaps people's image of the province a little bit outdated, actually. In any case, and Ricardo, do you have anything to add to that? In terms of, I mean, your book looks at differences between the various provinces, territories.
Yes, my spouse is Quebecois.
So, oh, right,
and I live in Ottawa, on the east side of Ottawa. So this question of, you know, Quebec versus Canada, Quebec versus other provinces, it's something that I think can talk a lot about. Mm-hmm. And just to reiterate what Catherine said, I think the challenge when we're talking about Quebec and trying to draw lessons from Quebec is to be able to grab on what is positive and what can inspire us, without romanticizing the current state of affairs in Quebec. Mm-hmm. Quebec still has many good things, but they're unfortunately, in my view, things that have been inherited from a period where the nationalist project was packaged with a social democratic agenda, and that it's no longer the case. Neoliberalism has been in full swing in Quebec for more than two decades right now, and we have seen, you know, the retreat of the state. We have seen cuts in social programs that have been quite systematic, and we're losing a lot. Right. When it comes to housing specifically, I think there are three things that we can look at Quebec for examples and for inspiration. One is a rent control regime that is not perfect, especially flawed on the question of vacancy controls, but it's stable, and its stability when it comes to rent control, it's a strength in itself. And that we don't see necessarily in other parts of the country, especially not in Ontario, where there's an expectation